Good morning and welcome to Listen Local, the bi-weekly webcast from Neighborhood News Source Mission Local. Under the new federal administration, we've heard a lot about sanctuary cities and how federal funding might be reduced to jurisdictions that proclaim themselves sanctuaries. Today, we'll talk about what exactly that means and what San Francisco and its immigrants can expect. I'm Laura Wenas, and joining me today is Saira Hussain. Saira is a staff attorney with the Criminal Justice Reform Program and works at Asian Americans Advancing Justice, also known as the Asian Law Caucus. Saira, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Can you start by giving us a little bit more background about the scope of your work with immigrants and with immigration law?
Sure. So our program at the Asian Law Caucus, the Criminal Justice Reform Program, focuses on disentangling local law enforcement from immigration. And currently, it's a very hot topic, especially when we're talking about sanctuary cities. We also have other programs within our office. We also represent immigrants in removal proceedings who are facing deportation. We also do housing and eviction rights. We do workers' rights. And at this point, it seems a lot of these issues are really intersecting, especially when we're talking about the undocumented community, people who are really afraid about, you know, seeking public benefits or being able to access services within the community because of their immigration status.
Is that something that you think is a valid fear? Do you think people are actually risking something when they go and seek these services?
That's not how it's supposed to happen. The problem is that right now under the Trump administration, there has been much talk about possibly trying to deport people who have been on public assistance in many different types of forms, people who are seen as quote-unquote public charges. Recently we've seen a decrease in the number of people who've gone to get food stamps, for example, or get public housing. And I think it's a real issue in terms of how much fear is pervading the community when it comes to seeking assistance from the government, because they're fearful that it could lead to their deportation.
So you've seen a lot of what people go through every day. Obviously, there's a lot of fear. What does it mean then to be a sanctuary city? And let's talk about San Francisco specifically. I know there's a myth out there that people think being a sanctuary city means ICE just can't come in, which is not true. What does it actually mean?
The definition of a sanctuary city is there is no one definition. And in fact, it just refers to a locality that has introduced some kind of policy that in any way limits collaboration between local law enforcement and ICE, or allows immigrants to access services just like any other person in the community would. Yesterday we were on a panel. One of the panelists mentioned that, you know, even something as simple as municipal IDs could be seen as possibly being a sanctuary city, where you're allowing people who may not be able to get other forms of valid identification because of lack of status to get municipal IDs so they can access services in the city. Things like welcoming city policies. So it's a very, very broad term that doesn't have a fixed definition. And you're right that there is a misnomer that sanctuary cities welcome people for purposes of crime, and that's not the case at all. In fact, recent studies have found that sanctuary cities actually lead to stronger economies and have lower rates of crime. There's a report that was done by Tom Wong, who's an associate professor at the University of California, San Diego, in which he found that sanctuary cities actually have 35 fewer crimes per 10,000 people in comparable cities of scale. And moreover, that their economies are stronger. And when you think about it, it makes sense. If somebody feels comfortable reporting to the police if they're the victim of or witness to crime, we're going to have lower crime rates. And moreover, when somebody feels like they're fully able to integrate into their community and they're able to do things like, you know, form their own business or seek employment, we're going to have stronger economies. And moreover, you know, in cities where there's a lot of collaboration between police and immigration, you do see higher rates of deportation. And when this deportation occurs, often it's the breadwinner that's being deported, and their children and spouses are left behind and often then have to go on public assistance. And so when you look at what the studies show, a lot of it does stem from, you know, common sense.
So, but let's back up for a second and talk about San Francisco specifically. Like you mentioned, being a sanctuary city can mean a lot of different things. San Francisco does have a municipal ID option, but San Francisco also limits collaboration between local law enforcement and ICE, if I remember correctly. Can you tell us what form that takes? What exactly are they not allowed to do?
Sure. So this is a result of several policies that have been passed. The first one was in 1989 in San Francisco. It was called the City and County of Refuge Ordinance. And that was a sanctuary city policy. And I found out just yesterday from a former supervisor, actually a board chair, Angela Alioto, that their sanctuary policy was passed in 1989 because just a few months before the passage, there had been many, many people at this place called Club Elegante, which was a dance club. And there were many people there just gathered together to have a good time. And apparently while they were there, then Immigration and Naturalization Services, now known as Immigration and Customs Enforcement, raided the club to pick up people. And there weren't enough agents to pick up all the people that were in the club. And so they called in the SFPD and the district attorney's office. And those people came in and started rounding individuals up. And they weren't distinguishing either between immigration status. So they picked up a lot of U.S. citizens along with undocumented people. And apparently the deportations were so swift that the people were picked up at night and deported the next day.
Yeah, former Supervisor Alioto was saying last night, I was also at this panel, that she and a fellow supervisor at the time came to the Mission District where this club was the next day, and in the area you could see children sitting on doorsteps because their parents were gone. They had been deported overnight.
Right. I mean, that is, you know, that's horrifying to hear something like that. So in 1989, we passed our first sanctuary ordinance. Then in 2013, we passed the Due Process for All Ordinance. And this was in response to immigration's shifting tactics. So beginning in about 2008, then President Bush initiated the Secure Communities Program, which started out in a few pilot programs across some jails and then spread by 2013 to every single jail in the country. What it does is that when somebody enters into a local jail at booking, their fingerprints are taken and then transmitted through several different databases, one of which is run by immigration. Mm-hmm. Immigration then identifies somebody as potentially being deportable. There's, you know, oftentimes they have misinformation, and will then issue what's known as an immigration hold, asking the local law enforcement agency to hold that person for up to 48 hours past their release time. So that was something where people were being held for extra time in order to just effectuate their deportation.
So the justice system had already decided they were ready to be released back into society.
Exactly.
And past that point, they would be held for another 48 hours in order for what, to wait for ICE agents to come pick them up?
Exactly. So just to carry out immigration enforcement. And the really troubling thing about these immigration holds is that they were not signed by a federal judge. They were signed by a deportation officer from the same agency. And it said on its face something like, we're initiating the investigation of whether this person may be deportable, right? So this document lacked probable cause. It was not a judicial warrant, and people were being held for additional time. Under the Fourth Amendment, that constitutes a new seizure, and it must be justified by probable cause. And so subsequently, you know, after we passed our local ordinance here, the Due Process for All Ordinance in 2013, there were many federal courts that found, just like we had suspected, that these immigration holds lacked constitutionality, that they were unconstitutional. So in 2013, in response to these immigration holds, we passed a policy here in San Francisco that said we will not hold somebody for additional time to carry out their deportation in the vast majority of cases. Mm-hmm. And then in 2016, just last year, we passed a further update to the Sanctuary and Due Process for All ordinances. And this is once again to respond to the shifting nature of immigration. Now, instead of seeking immigration holds, they had shifted to this thing where they were trying to seek notification of when a person was going to be released. Now, once again, this person had been deemed by the justice system safe to return to the community. And oftentimes what it was leading to was jails sort of covertly holding people for additional time in order for immigration to make their way there. So they were saying, oh, we're just notifying, which in the first place would lead to that person again ending up in immigration custody, leading to lower trust in our local law enforcement agencies. And then secondly, we saw these things that we call warm handoffs, where somebody was, you know, in the release area for several additional hours without any sort of rationale. And suddenly they would be told, okay, you can leave now. And behind them would be an immigration officer in the locked portion of the jail to pick them up.
Wow. So now, what's the state of things now? We have laws on the books that say police officers can't be deputized as ICE agents.
So that that already exists because we do not have what's known as a 287G agreement with immigration, and that essentially deputizes local law enforcement to act as immigration agents.
Okay.
You see that in places like Maricopa County, where former Sheriff Joe Arpaio was carrying out these horrific, you know, racial profiling scandals and just basically terrorizing the immigrant community there.
But so we don't have it here.
We don't have it here. So here in San Francisco, what the law currently is we will not be holding people for additional time for immigration purposes in the vast majority of cases. We will not be notifying ICE of somebody's release upon from custody in the vast majority of cases. We're not allowed to respond to civil immigration detainers, civil immigration warrants, which are not actual warrants. They're signed, once again, by a deportation officer.
But they say warrant on the front, right? Which causes a lot of confusion.
Exactly. Yes. They say warrant. It's not a real warrant. And in the vast majority of cases, immigration is, they're not allowed to enter our jails either.
Uh-huh.
And so, in the majority of cases, what we tell immigration is, look, if you have a judicial warrant, you can come and pick up who you want. But absent that, we're not going to start turning people over to you.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how this has played out practically. And I want to talk about two examples. One is one that is often used by people who very strongly oppose sanctuary cities, which is the story of what happened with Kate Steinle, who is a woman who was killed by a ricocheting bullet on the Embarcadero in San Francisco. And the bullet was fired from a stolen gun carried by an undocumented immigrant who had already been deported a few times. And to my knowledge, what happened is that the man was arrested, and after the justice system, like we said, deemed him releasable, he was released. And people are frustrated about this because they perceive this as a person who should be deported. What are your thoughts on that, and does that argument make sense?
So first off, I just really want to recognize what a tragedy that was. It was very, very sad to learn about what happened to Kate Steinle. And I think there are many people who have used what happened to her to exploit on a national level the idea of sanctuary cities. And I'm talking specifically about people like Donald Trump, who very soon after it happened, you know, kind of used it to back his xenophobic and nationalist agenda. So I think that there's a lot of misconceptions about what it means to be a sanctuary city, and in particular, what happened and how it played out in the case of Kate Steinle. There were a lot of, I guess, factors that sort of came together in a confluence. So first, you had somebody who had been held by the Bureau of Prisons, who had just served out a term, and for some reason was transferred back to San Francisco on an old warrant for a $20 marijuana possession charge from like 1995.
And this was done, again, by the justice system, the government, not he fled here because he thought he was going to get sanctuary.
Right. It was the Department of, it was the Bureau of Prisons, which is run by the federal government.
Okay.
That transferred him back to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, $20 marijuana possession charge, the DA does not prosecute that. And that, the evidence was gone. It was 20 years old. So, once they realized, okay, this person is never even somebody we'd even prosecute, they released him, as they should have. Later on, you also found out that the gun that was used was a gun that was stolen from a Bureau of Land Management agent who had come into San Francisco and had left his weapon unsecured. I think it was either an unlocked car or it was in plain view. And the person who's suspected of stealing the gun is not the same individual who's on trial for Kate Sedami's killing.
Hmm.
And so, you know, one of the ways that we responded here in the city and then on the statewide level was to actually require that anybody who's bringing a weapon in and carrying a weapon in an unsecured, in a vehicle, must have it secured either in a locked box or a locked trunk. Because there had been a series, and the Mercury News, I believe, did a report about this, but a series of gun thefts, especially from law enforcement officials who had left their guns unsecured in vehicles. The other issue is, you know, this individual is still about to stand trial, so I think we're going to find out some more information.
Mm-hmm.
But there are definitely questions as to substance abuse issues and possible mental health issues. And I think to blame it on sanctuary cities is just something that I think it's convenient for people who want to fit it into a particular narrative. But I think when you look at the real facts of what happened, I really don't think that that's a factor into you know, this tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that this is somebody who, you know, regardless of personal views, but according to law, should have been deported after what happened?
I believe that he was serving out a term for coming back into the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he was in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons, because he was serving out a federal prison sentence. And I believe in a situation like that, they normally would have deported him.
Mm-hmm.
Again.
And like you said, he's still going to stand trial.
Yes, that's right. Because what happens in the U.S. is that if somebody is, despite if they're documented or not, they first have to go through the criminal justice system and serve out the term there before the U.S. can effectuate their deportation.
Mm-hmm. So now let's talk about sort of the flip side, which is a case of a person who I believe you're representing, who went to a police station, a San Francisco resident, who went to a police station to pick up a stolen car or to report a stolen car, and then there was picked up by immigration agents.
Right. So that's my client, Pedro Figueroa. In December of 2015, he went to the SFPD. He had already reported his car stolen, and he got a call earlier in the morning saying the car had been recovered, but that he went down to the impound lot, and they told him that he needed a release from the SFPD before he could pick up the car.
Hmm.
So he went to the closest SFPD station. And he turned over his consular ID, which is identification, and his registration for the car, and then waited. Soon after that, he was arrested by two SFPD officers while waiting in the lobby area for his release. They didn't tell him anything, and they took him to a back area where he waited for some period of time. In the meantime, his wife had no idea what was happening. She had been sitting in the lobby with him. And so she ran back to try to find somebody who could help interpret, because they're both also limited English proficient. So he's waiting in the back area. And at some point, they tell him, you know, you're free to leave. And they walk him out of a side door of the station, not the main entrance. It's an unmarked side door. And as soon as they open the door and unhandcuff him outside, he's immediately met by two immigration agents. And what we found out later was that while, you know, once he had given his consular ID and they ran a warrant check on him before returning the car, and they found an outstanding civil immigration warrant. So remember how I mentioned this a little while back? And those are warrants that are not signed by a judge. The reason why he had the civil immigration warrant, which he did not even know at the time, is because in 2005, when he came into the country, he was, you know, Customs and Border Protection basically took down an address for him, and he proceeded to come to San Francisco because he had family that lived here, and they told him that he'd be receiving a court date, and he never received anything.
Hmm.
So apparently what happened was they either didn't take down the address correctly or they never mailed it, but he was ordered deported in absentia, meaning he wasn't present, by a judge in Texas in 2005, and he never knew about it until this instance. And so since then, you know, he was picked up, like I said, by immigration. He spent 2 months in immigration detention away from his family, and he was finally released after an immigration judge reopened that removal order, the one that was issued when he wasn't there, and said, you know, he needed proper notice. So he has a pending immigration case. And in the meantime, you know, there have been a lot of questions to SFPD as to what happened. Was there a failure in terms of policy? Was there a rogue officer? We, you know, are really trying to get at this and to ensure that this never happens to anyone again, especially because within the Latino community, within the undocumented community, Pedro's story has been heard and it's very widespread. And there are people who are afraid to come forward and say, I'm the victim of crime, because they saw what happened to Pedro when he reported his car is stolen.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about that fear, because there is a lot of confusion about what a sanctuary is and isn't, but there's also just generally sort of a precautionary fear of going to the police because of stories like this, because of the current political climate, even though this happened before Trump was elected. And, you know, we've seen that at Mission Local. People, one person has come into the office and said, I have been sexually assaulted, but I don't want to go to the police because I don't have proper documentation. And I know we're supposed to be a sanctuary city, but I don't know what those officers think off duty. I don't know what their personal politics are. So would you, as somebody who advocates for immigrants, would you tell an undocumented immigrant, would you recommend generally that they do report crime to the police?
You know, I think that that's what the sanctuary policy is intended to do. That's the reason why it was passed in the first place. I think that, you know, when it comes to me as an advocate for immigrant communities, I try to lay out the most objective pieces that I know of and explain to them, you know, some of the reasons they may or may not want to go to the police, and basically empower the person with the full set of facts so they can make their own decision, depending on their situation. And so, you know, in like I mentioned, in cases like Pedro's, there has been a fear. And so one of the major things that we really want to ensure is that we're not just a sanctuary city by word of mouth, that we're not, it's not just lip service that we're paying. We're not just saying, you know what, we're welcoming, we welcome all individuals and leave it at that, but rather that we're actually practicing that each and every day. And that starts with ensuring that our law enforcement agencies and our law enforcement officers are fully trained in the sanctuary policy. And we see a failure of that in what happened in Pedro's case. And we want to make sure, too, that if there are officers who are feeling emboldened as a result of the Trump administration, that they understand what the parameters are around sanctuary city and that they're following those policies. So we want to make sure that there's not only full training to ensure people who may not be informed in terms of officers and carrying out what their obligations under the sanctuary policy, but also making sure we're accounting for anybody who's trying to act intentionally and turn people over to immigration in that way. I think it is a complicated equation. And I think that, you know, I have been asked by people, especially those who have mistrust in the criminal justice system as well, about, you know, what they should do. And I really think that providing them with the full information is really important to make sure that people are making their decisions based on the full set of information that they have.
So let's talk now about what might happen to San Francisco because it is a sanctuary city. We're hearing a lot of talk from the federal government in various forms about taking away funding. And yesterday at this panel, I heard a variety of estimates that nobody's really committing to yet, because this is going to play out in the courts and it may be found completely invalid anyway to withdraw some of this funding. San Francisco gets something like almost 20% of its funding from federal grants and other programs, but it could also just be as little as a few hundred million. So the amount is not really clear. But what I want to ask you is if you have a sense of whether the city, obviously you can't speak for city government, but if you have a sense of whether the city is committed to keeping these policies in place, whether or not we have that funding from the federal government. In other words, do you think that this threat of withdrawing funding is going to have an impact on how San Francisco acts as a sanctuary city?
I, you know, there's been a lot of individuals, including the mayor, including members of the Board of Supervisors, who have come out and reaffirmed their commitment to remaining a sanctuary city in the wake of Trump's election. And I think that that's really important, first of all, to send that message loud and clear to the immigrant community that we're not going to turn our backs on you. I think that there is a lot of fear, not necessarily, you know, partially maybe within the city, but also around the country, where you see jurisdictions who perhaps are considering declaring themselves sanctuaries, but are saying, well, what if the federal government takes away our funding, you know? And I think that is a real fear, especially if the federal government's grants are funding a, you know, big chunk of the city's budget. I think there's a few things to remember here. The first is that although the threats have been made by the Justice Department and Jeff Sessions that they're going to strip cities who declare themselves as sanctuaries of funding, that is not backed by any sort of legal standing. So there's well-established case law that states that the federal government cannot commandeer local resources to carry out the federal government's work. And that's under the 10th Amendment. And surprisingly, the cases that support that are actually cases that have been brought by conservatives. There's a case called Prince v. United States. And in that case, the federal government was asking local law enforcement officials to run background checks on people who wanted to get guns. And that was invalidated because you can't commandeer local resources to carry out the federal government's work. And when it comes to the Second Amendment, that's the federal government's work. If it's federal government's law, they can't have the locals enforce them to expend their resources on carrying it out. Same thing with immigration enforcement. That is purely the purview of the federal government. So they can't force our agencies to then notify them or hold people for additional time, once again, on our own dime. So there's that case law. And moreover, San Francisco, along with Santa Clara and now Richmond, now Seattle, possibly Salinas, have all sued the federal government because of this threat of stripping money from sanctuary cities. And that case is supposed to be heard, the preliminary injunction on that case is supposed to be heard on April 14th here in San Francisco at the federal courthouse. And that is for both the San Francisco and Santa Clara cases.
Great. Sorry, we're almost out of time. Maybe really quickly to close, you can just give a shout out to any organizations that you think people should go to if they're worried or they need help figuring out what their options are. Where can people go for help?
Absolutely. So there is a collaborative of 13 immigrant rights organizations known as SF Island, the San Francisco Immigrant Legal and Education Network. And you can go to sfisland.org, sfilen.org. And they have information there for Know Your Rights. They have information there for consultations. And many of those organizations are available to provide free consultations to people who are concerned about their immigration status.
Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We'll be back 2 weeks from today with news and narratives from the neighborhood. You've been listening to Listen Local via BFF.fm. Thanks for listening. Raised by wolves of necessity. Come closer to me.